Comforting the afflicted, afflicting the comfortable, bringing faith to the doubtful, doubt to the faithful, friend to the friendless, odor to the odorless, telling lame radio to rise and talk. This is Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian. Tonight, from the studios of News Talk Radio 810 WGY in Albany, New York, I will tell you more about why in just a moment. But thank you, everybody, that's been so hospitable here. Dave and Steve and Greg and Jim and the guy in the red sweatshirt, whose name I forgot for the moment. Glastonbury. It is, by most accounts, the oldest church in England, with a Christian history dating back perhaps to AD 47, but almost certainly to AD 166, when an earlier structure was named for St. Mary. Its real history begins long before the coming of Jesus. All that can be said with any certainty is that there were pre-Christian religious sites in the area, that the Celts had an early Christian church essentially independent of Rome on this ground, and that the Great Abbey was only the last in a long succession of shrines. Legend has it that Joseph of Arimathea, who is reputed to have introduced Christianity into Britain, brought the blood of Jesus to Glastonbury and founded the first Celtic church. There's also an intriguing story that Glastonbury was the Isle of Avalon, that King Arthur was buried there, and that Camelot was nearby. Historic record begins with King Ine of Wessex, who built the first portions of the modern Glastonbury Abbey in the 8th century. The next 150 years are vague, but the abbey was refounded under Benedictine, not Celtic, rules at about 943 by a priest known today as St. Dunstan. From then until the 16th century, the abbey prospered more than any other church in England. To some, its religious significance was comparable to that of Rome, and three kings, Edmund, Edgar, and Edmund Ironside, vouchsafed its importance by choosing to be buried there. In 1184, the abbey and its buildings were almost totally destroyed by fire, but were rebuilt almost immediately by Henry II. From Henry II's rebuilding, Glastonbury had an unbroken 400-year history of expansion and prestige. Thousands of pilgrims came to its doors. Merchants from all over England and even from the continent traded with the skilled monks and artisans who manufactured everything from ale to clocks to gloves. From these sources and great land holdings came enormous wealth for the monks of Glastonbury. They made it possible for a succession of abbots to maintain an almost continuous building and refurbishing program until the abbey was virtually a town in itself. Some reports say as many as 100 buildings. This church, its altars, weighted with gold and jewels, its library, its workshops, vineyards and fields, a university, stood far above common, even noble medieval life. But within little more than a decade, its glory ended. When Henry VIII refused to recognize the Pope's authority, Glastonbury's day was over, and its Benedictine tradition doomed. It had sufficient power to be one of the last Catholic churches suppressed, but within a very short time after its closing, every building but the abbot's kitchen had been pulled down, the stones taken away to be used for roads, barns, and farmhouses. By the reign of Elizabeth I, except for legend, nothing but the abbot's kitchen, a few ruined walls, and some half-buried foundations remained of what had been one of the most important churches in England. That is how Glastonbury remained until a man named Frederick Bligh Bond. Frederick Bligh Bond. He brought it back to be the center of activity when he and a friend and colleague named Captain John Allen Bartlett got together on a November afternoon in 1907 after joining hands over a pen set over a piece of parchment. Bly, Bond, and Bartlett turned to the spirits and asked, "Can you tell us anything of Glastonbury?" And they did. Who moved Captain Bartlett's hand? What did they tell Bond and Bartlett? What is psychic archaeology? And what does it tell us about the quest for man's beginnings? These are many of the words of Stefan Schwartz. The book is The Secret Vaults of Time. And next hour, we're going to explore psychic archaeology. Just who was in the room with Bond and Bartlett? Just what were they telling them? And what of psychic archaeology? How have spirits reached through time to tell modern archaeologists where to find the buildings they're looking for under what are often yards of dirt in the middle of unmarked fields? It is a most extraordinary story. And we'll tell you that story coming up next hour. News next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I have news and I have some email to share here in just a second. If you've been to the coasttocoastam.com website, you're seeing some very colorful and creative artwork pursuant to a topic from so long ago, there's no point in really going over it again, except those are many of the pictures that you all created, photoshopped of me with a beard. And let's just leave it at that. But they're very funny, and thank you, everybody, put the time into it. And thank you, everybody, who sends in news and email during the week. We have an update coming up in just a second on our mass consciousness experiment last week. And a couple of comments about the show with Mary Roach and others. As long as you're at coasttocoastam.com, take a look at that story about the Roslyn Chapel's carvings explained. At least according to the new book, Roslyn and the Grail, by Mark Oxbrough and Ian Robertson. They say it's none of the things that we've been led to believe, you know, that it's either the final resting place for Jesus's head, Templar treasure, anything like that, anything that's connected to the Da Vinci Code. I'll let you sort it out when you go there and take a look at that. They say that linking the founder of the chapel to the Knights Templar is an abomination. I saw a fireball, the story that comes out of England too. A sudden intense fireball exploded on the A16 in Louth, a motorist has claimed. Returning from a long jury, pensioner Michael Nixon was 300 yards short of the A16 roundabout near Kenwick. The former serviceman has no explanation for what happened next. Mr. Nixon, 74, said, "I experienced what I can only describe as a fireball directly in front of my windscreen. An explosive flash of red light occurred, appearing to be the size of a football, but filling my field of vision." He said it only lasted a second, but the intensity and suddenness caused me to flinch. My eyes hurt. There was no noise, no sign of smoke, and my car was unmarked. Was this seen by anybody else? Well, I like the story that is floating about. It's interesting to contrast this with some other rights issues that have popped up in the news. Selena Jarvis, it says here in the Alternet story, has assigned to her civics class and economics class to take photographs to illustrate their rights in the Bill of Rights. One student did. He had taken a photo of President George Bush out of a magazine and tacked the picture to a wall with a red thumbtack through the president's head, then took a photo of that. Then that was being developed over at a Walmart where somebody tipped off the Secret Service. An employee at that Walmart photo department called the Kitty Hawk police on the student. The Kitty Hawk police turned the matter over to the Secret Service. They've been investigating. Meanwhile, New York Times is reporting this evening into tomorrow's edition that the reporter, Judith Miller, who went to jail for 85 days for refusing to testify and reveal her confidential source on the name Valerie Plame, cannot recall who actually gave her the name. She said, "I believed the information came from another source whom I could not recall." She says she spent 85 days in jail protecting a source that she could not remember. I am sure more on that ahead. And I'm sure George read the story earlier in the week, but somebody emailed it to me anyway, from Angelo State University, where they caught a two-headed diamondback rattler. It was a young one, only about as thick as an adult human finger, but both heads were working. Chris McAllister, a visiting professor of biology at Angelo State University, said he found the snake after turning over 400 to 500 rocks last month in a ranch area where he and students were scouring for interesting specimens. They sure found one. And the great pity of this, of course, is we need rattlesnakes. They're good for our environment. And we'll never know what this rattlesnake would have been capable of. A double-headed rattler? Shoe-in for law school? I think so. I'm in Albany, New York tonight, courtesy of News Talk Radio 810 WGY, because I was on the East Coast at a monastery, which was open for retreats. In fact, they're open for anybody. If you ever want to go to a retreat, you don't have to be religious, even if you just want some days of silence. There's no obligation. If you want to see it, you can go online and look at holycrossmonastery.com. If you go to holycrossmonastery.com, you look at the bell tower, and then just underneath where the bells ring at 5:30 in the morning, you go straight down from there. And that was where my room was, right underneath the bells. And you can book time there if you'd like. It was terrific, and it was interesting, and it was particularly compelling because it's a Benedictine, it's an Episcopal Benedictine order. And some of the material in the book coming up next hour, The Secret Vaults of Time, is in pursuit of a long buried and almost forgotten Benedictine monastery in England, in Glastonbury. And so I'm sitting in a room in a Benedictine monastery just outside of Poughkeepsie, New York, reading about the pursuit through psychic archaeology of this buried Benedictine monastery in Glastonbury. And at times, it all felt like it was just kind of compressing time together, like it was just reaching out over the centuries as I sat there and read in the monastery where I was staying. And that's exactly the experience of psychic archaeologists. They suddenly are living in real time, and they can look at the buildings. They see, they walk through in a field. They can see a picture of what it used to be like, walk through it, look down, and know right where to dig. And it happens time and time again. Stefan Schwartz has done an amazing job with that book, and we'll be talking about it coming up next hour. Last week, we did a mass consciousness experiment for Jared, a boy who is suffering. Gary's his father. He said thank you. He emailed this week to say that he was listening, and tears flowed when you all did what you tried to do and help my son. He wanted to tell us that it doesn't seem to have helped yet. And he still exhibits severe mental disabilities. Prior to this happening, he was a thriving, intelligent, employed person. Since he's been able to not do much. The reason we all got sick, Gary said at the same time, is because after 5 years of rain and the mold building up on our walls, the apartment re-roofed our apartment. And when the apartment was tested for mold, we had six different toxic molds at 21,000 times the healthy limit. Makes you really wonder what people are going to be going through down in New Orleans. Somebody emailed in and said there's a website called vitamincoach.com that has information like this where people are benefiting. Don't know. I listened to your show Saturday night and was totally humiliated, writes Juanita. She said she was listening to us last week with Mary Roach talk about ghosts. I shared some of my ghost stories, personal experiences. And Juanita said she was totally humiliated as it slowly dawned on me that I, a grown-up, was going to have to reach over and turn on that bedside lamp. Continuing to listen, I was further shamed when I knew that I was going to have to get up and lock the bedroom door. That elevator in the old funeral home combined with the night watchman in the chapel was more than I could bear. After shivering and chattering as long as I could stand it, I finally gave up and turned the show off. I had to watch middle-of-the-night TV infomercials to get my balance back. She said, I've heard lots of stuff on Coast to Coast, but there's something about very straight-up, logical, skeptical people who don't really believe in this stuff telling you things that harrow up thy soul. I don't know what you have in store next Saturday, but I hope it's more benign. Juanita, not by much. Regarding the show about RFID technology and spy chips, Rick wanted to throw in another branch to the tree of this debate on the issue, which he hasn't heard anybody talk about. If each item on Earth is numbered and unique unto itself, what would be the result if an item I purchased was later found at a crime scene, he asks. What a method of muddying the waters of an investigation for the criminal. Simply pick up a few items from any trash can, later drop them at the scene. Each would be identifiable as to who purchased it and when, so all these people would have to be eliminated. Great show topic, and I hope I will occasionally resurface as the plot thickens. And indeed, the plot was probably thickening today down in Dallas. Need a report on that. Same thing with another story in from Dennis, who's talking about these smart pills. He said, you know, people will probably take them if it means to, you know, improve their health. And that's so often how it does begin. Josh says, dear man ferret, Maury Povich is the shadow puppet for Jerry Springer. Josh, you know how to hurt a guy. Connie writes in my astrology charts. She said, there are years that are business as usual and years that shake us up. It looks like you're going to have a shakeup year in 2006. She's taking my challenge. And so she is, she's giving me my charts and she says, go ahead, test me. So I'll be watching, and thank you, Connie. As I always say to my kids when they get in the car, buckle up, buckaroos. It could get a little bumpy. And finally, and I'll just mention this once, that in Albany, there is a restaurant, and it's actually near here in Latham, right? And it's called the 76. Do I have that right? The 76 Diner, and it's just a half mile south of the Latham Circle, and that's where I'll be when we get off the air at 5 a.m., and if you're there, we'd love to meet you. Now, I can't be there for long because I got to catch a flight out, but if you're there at that one place, at that one time, it'll be fun to sit down with you for a few minutes, at least have a cup of coffee, And this is how we'll know, you know, it's us, is all you have to do is just say, hello, ferret face. That's your code. Just say, hello, ferret face. And I'll know that it's you looking for me. But I have to warn you that if it's a replay, I won't be there. So this is only good for here, October 16th. So if you're listening to this next week, I won't be there. And or if there's another place called the 76 Diner near your house and it's not in Latham, New York, don't go there and say, hello, ferret face. Because if you walk into a diner and it's not this date and it's not that place, someone's going to punch your lights out. So truly the definition of a one-time only offer. But I look forward to seeing you there for at least a few. And stick around. Interesting story to be shared coming up next on what the drug companies really are doing. You think the marketing's bad from what you see on TV. How about the other side of the screen? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Oh, man, Ross just makes that sound so good, doesn't it? I couldn't ever. There's not enough testosterone replacement therapy in the world that could get me to sound that good. And I know now if I did have all of that, you know, testosterone replacement therapy only, and maybe then could I ever grow beards as amazing as the ones you all have photoshopped at coasttocoastam.com. It started off funny. It started off like really one of those things that we all just couldn't stop chuckling over, but it's reached into a new level now. As the photos keep coming in, it gets sick. It's just dark. It's just hysterical. So thank you, Sean, webmaster for the weekends. Great job on that gallery, such as it is. I wish you had better material to work with than my face, but and thank you, everybody. And thank you, Kathleen Slattery Moscow. We'll get to her in just a second. You know, we have often talked about Big Pharma on this show, about the reach and influence of the pharmaceutical industry. And while at the same time acknowledging that there are some wonderful things that pharmaceutical companies do, there are, it seems, some unique excesses. And we get just glimpses of what that's really like. But Kathleen has lived it. And in fact, she's made a movie about it, opening up across the country this weekend. We'll go back in time a bit to what got Kathleen the job as a pharmaceutical sales representative and what she learned along the road of 10 years selling drugs to doctors, the things that she was told by the pharmaceutical companies for whom she worked. It's, if it weren't so tragic, it would be funny. Maybe that's why Kathleen had to turn it into a comedy when she made it into a movie, but she'll tell us the real story next on Coast to Coast AM. Around the country, in selected theaters, a new movie is opening up this weekend, which opens up a new way of looking at the pharmaceutical industry. It's called Side Effects, and Kathleen Slattery Moscow joins us on Coast to Coast AM. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you again.
And I have since seen the movie, which I hadn't the first time we had chatted. And so I don't know how many people can go see it. I don't know where it's available yet. What kind of distribution are you getting for Side Effects?
We are actually self-distributing the film. We opened in Dallas. We actually opened in Dallas a few weeks ago, and we're doing a rolling release. So we opened in Dallas. 2 weeks later, we were in Boston. This weekend, we opened in the Minneapolis area at the Marcus Oakdale Cinemas. And then and then we're going on to San Francisco and Berkeley, and it's about every 2 weeks from there.
And so far, how are your box office receipts? Are they
good,
helping to pay for the rollout?
Yeah, they're helping to fund the rollout. A theatrical release is never a big money maker, but if it can help us bring the film to a wider audience and continue to roll out across the country, that's our main goal. But it takes people coming to the theaters and seeing the film, and we're a little low-budget indie film and not a lot of advertising dollars. So we heavily rely on programs like this, and we're word of mouth to get the film, or to get the word about the film out there.
Well, and the film was made for under $200,000.
Yes, which in the world of filmmaking in general is incredibly low. A lot of the very low budget indie films these days, independent films, are going for $2 million plus. So
even as indie films go, you're on the low end of the indie film.
Yes, we're on the very low end.
Okay. You're kind of just above maybe, you know, a commercial for a drive-in movie theater on cable. I mean,
exactly.
You're kind of right in that ballpark.
That's right.
But you got it made.
Little film, but we're trying to pack a big message here.
And you got it made, and you actually have somebody who's doing pretty well since they shot that movie with you, the woman that's on Grey's Anatomy.
Yes, Katherine Heigl from Grey's Anatomy. She is our lead actress, and she does a phenomenal job in Side Effects. We were just blown away by her, and we were very fortunate, obviously, to get her because, obviously, Grey's Anatomy is doing very well. And we were very fortunate because she fell in love with the script, and she was available. And she's, like I said, she's just done a phenomenal job with the film.
Well, and it's a comedy, and we'll just let people go see it and where they can, or when it comes to their, you know, local rental place, be able to grab it on DVD sometime.
Absolutely, and all the show times are listed on our website, so they can check it out there as well.
Okay, and you can link up to Kathleen via coasttocoastam.com. But there are parts of the story that even through the humor of it points to something which probably didn't seem so funny at the time, or maybe doesn't seem so funny now when you look back on it. And so let's talk a little bit about the pharmaceutical business, big pharma. We talk about it a lot on the show, and we're always interested in how deep its reach goes, and some of the ways in which it can influence public policy, the ways in which some of us are experiencing our medical care. But more than that, too, I mean, we hear stories about Vioxx, and we hear about some of the other, what seems like, and it just seems like, abuses by the pharmaceutical industry, all focused on profits. Now, you became a pharmaceutical sales rep on what qualifications?
Well, I was a political science major.
Okay.
And actually, right after college, I went to work for the cellular phone industry.
Okay, so you sold cell phones, and you were a political science major in college.
And
so there's no real, like, medical background to work with here.
None whatsoever. No science background, nothing along those lines.
All right, so how did you get, I mean, why do you think they chose you? I know what you imply in the movie is because they chose you because you're pretty, and you'd be able to talk at, you know, and bat some eyes at doctors and get attention that maybe some, you know, moron like me couldn't get. True?
Well, you know, if you look across the industry, it's an inside joke within the industry and actually within the medical community that pharmaceutical reps, it's a sea of good-looking people. And at the time, again, I was a political science major. I was young. I was fresh out of college. And again, I had no business telling doctors how to prescribe drugs, but I seemed to land the job anyway, and I was just one of many fitting a similar bill. And I actually one time asked one of my managers about it because it just seemed so odd that everywhere you looked were these beautiful people, both men and women. And they said, he basically told me that the reason that they do it is to give the doctor cause for pause in their day. They spend all day long looking at sick people, a lot of times elderly people. And if you can put someone young and vivacious and charismatic in front of them, regardless if they have experience, the doctor, you know, it will give the doctor a reason to pause. On the male side, just to kind of give you some insight, you know, obviously physicians can be male or female, but a lot of times the office staff are females, and a lot of times the good-looking younger males have a lot better chance getting past the office staff to the physicians, you know, based on their charm and their good looks, and it works. It's worked for years, and that's why they do it.
And it's not just good looks; it's food. too. That there, seems like there's a lot of seems like there's a lot of bribery with food and alcohol going on.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We would laugh when we were in the industry that, you know, really we didn't need our undergrad degree, our history majors and our drama majors to do this job. We needed our catering degree because, you know, it was a lot of schlepping in food for breakfasts and lunches and then wining dining physicians in the evening at the finest restaurants. There's a lot of food involved in this business.
And trips and travel?
You know, I can honestly say but that during the time frame that I was, you know, pushing pills, a lot of that was already that was being curbed at that point.
That was on its way out.
Yeah, that was on its way out. But, you know, in the end, it really doesn't matter. It's all the same. It's all about spinning it, whether you're flying them out to an island to do it or you're taking them to the finest restaurants. You're still just feeding them the company line, and that's all the very positive things about the drugs.
So here you have political science majors, theater majors, communications majors, people who know how to charm and people who are attractive, male and female. And that's the focus of getting the best pitch out for the pharmaceutical company. They want good-looking people with kind of a handout of something good here in order to get doctors just to write prescriptions. And it's kind of on that basis that you really got paid or bonused, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the primary way that I received my compensation was by how many pills I could sell. It was not necessarily how intelligently I could speak to the medications or how strong my background was in science or how well I educated the doctor. It was how many pills I pushed through my territory, because they got the reports on the territory level as to how many prescriptions for that particular drug were being sold. And it was so my performance was solely based on profitability.
Okay, but see, when you were saying educating the doctor,
yeah, I put that in quotes.
Again, it's like you—I mean, nothing against you. You know, a smart woman. You found a way to get an indie film made for under $200,000. You're no dope, but I mean, what you educating a doctor? Do we really want that kind of system where the pharmaceutical sales reps are quote unquote educating our physicians?
That was, you know, the basis for making the film. I mean, there's so much more to it than that, but I mean, that was the irony of the whole situation. I had no business talking to doctors about drugs or telling your doctor or educating your doctor which drugs to write for you. I did not have the background, and I had no business doing it. And even to this day, after having made the film and sitting here, you know, working for the industry for a decade, making the film and sitting here tonight, I have a hard time believing that that's what I was hired to do. It still strikes me as odd.
Well, and especially because some of these drugs really aren't any different than some of their competitors on the market. So it all comes down to who's got the best looking salespeople and
who can market it better.
And who can market it better, who can take the doctors to the nicer restaurants.
Absolutely.
And get them to write more prescriptions.
I mean, that even comes down to what choices they make in terms of which drugs they choose to develop, because they just look at the best performing classes. So let's say they're looking at the antidepressant class, which is doing very well, and they decide we want a piece of that action. So they'll quickly develop a drug that is very similar, if not exactly the same as every other drug on the market, and then because they have confidence that they'll be able to spin it or market it better than the next team. So it's not which company can research the best drug or come up with the better drug. It all comes down to which company can market the drugs the best.
All
and
right,
that's
now,
the sad thing about it.
In the film side effects, the drug that is the focus of the film is something called Vivex, which sounds a lot like Vioxx. So were you out hawking Vioxx?
No, that is such an interesting story. I came up with the fictional name Vivex because I always knew, I mean, you know, having worked in the industry was just infatuated with drug names that had lots of V's and X's in them because they came across so powerful. So I came up with the fictional name Vivex, and it was absolutely, you know, by chance that the week that we finished shooting the film, that very week, the first Vioxx story broke. And again, you know, there's some similarities between what's happened with Vioxx and the storyline of the film, but it was all just by chance. So it's just interesting how that turned out.
Well, that's very interesting because it does parallel very much. I mean, there were certain things about Vioxx which were very promising, and then there were some side effects which were not being discussed, which then end up putting Vioxx back in the headlines for the reasons which the drug company didn't want. What were the things then of the drugs that you were selling? What were some of the things that worried you the most? And when you look back on it, do you ever feel responsible for anything which you lose sleep over?
I can't say that there's any one thing that I can personally point to or that I feel personally responsible for that I can think of with the specific drugs I sold. I did, over the course of the decade, as I was starting to grow up and mature and to, you know, grow into my own ethics and values, really started to question the world around me and the way that I was presenting the, in being told to present the drugs to physicians. We were only pulling out the pearls of the studies or the research that we were presenting to the doctors. We were really only talking about the positives and every now and then mentioning the side effects, but, you know, for the most part, it was just drawing out the very positives about the drug. And we were, you know, we were trained in a way that it was a very well-rehearsed pitch. So, you know, I would walk into a doctor's office and give them the pitch. I would also be told, you know, we would also be trained on exactly, you know, what are the top 10 objections you might hear from the physician. And we were told exactly and trained exactly what to say in regards to those objections. And typically, it was not necessarily a way of addressing the objection so much of it as it was a way of spinning it back towards the positive and evading the issue.
Well, it sounds
exactly
a lot more
what we're running into.
Yeah, you know. And this sounds a lot more like telemarketing. This sounds like somebody trying to sell me aluminum home siding.
And that is that is kind of the point of the entire film, is that, you know, we're not talking about selling widgets here. We're talking about medications that people take into their bodies that, you know, can be life-saving in some cases and life-threatening in others. And that's why everything that was so, you know, I guess on a day-to-day basis could be construed as almost humorous, I mean, or tongue-in-cheek humorous, and the fact that I was a political science major, you know, selling major drugs. I mean, there's so many moments throughout the film that have humor, but it's what's so funny, what was so funny about the entire situation that ultimately is what's so scary about the reality of the situation. And that's what I tried to get through in the film. And that's what we're dealing with today, that, you know, it's not, we really need to be taking a closer look at this because there are some very serious outcomes as we're seeing with Vioxx and some of the other drugs.
All right. When this comes up, when people talk in front of Congress, when this subject will pop up in the news, it seems like the major drug companies will often claim poverty and they'll say, hey, we're barely making it. We just, you know, there's just no way the margins on these pills that are hits help pay for all the pills that are losers and pays for all of this other research. And they always sound like they're teetering on the brink of bankruptcy. Based on your experience, 10 years as a pharmaceutical sales rep, three different companies over the 10 years, what do you hear in that? And what's been your experience?
You know, I guess if you look at the track record of the pharmaceutical industry, it has consistently been one of the most profitable industries out there. And it is a known fact that they spend almost almost twice the amount of money on marketing as they do research and development. So when they cry out and say, well, we have to charge the exorbitant prices that we do because of research and development. Otherwise, you know, there's not going to, you know, they play the fear card with us that there's suddenly going to be no money for research and development unless they charge the prices they do. But they're spending twice as much money on marketing. You know, I'll give you an example. We recently checked into the advertising rates on a certain station to run an ad for side effects, a 30-second spot. The ad rates for that 30-second spot were $350,000. Every time we turn on our television right now, we're bombarded by the commercials that we're seeing from the drug companies. It gives you some perspective as to how much money they're paying to market their drugs directly to consumers and paying the reps to market directly to physicians. So when they say that, you know, that the high cost of prescription medication is due to you know, the enormous amount spent on research and development, you know, it's a little odd when you think about how much money they're spending on marketing and research, or, you know, the marketing of the drugs. And one physician, said it very clearly. He said, you know, if you build it, we will come. If you build a truly superior drug that works better and is safer, we will use it, no spin needed. And right now, so much money is just being poured back into the spin that you have really don't have the kind of money being poured back into research and development that you need to develop these truly superior drugs. So it's, you raise an excellent point.
Well, we'll just let people decide the rest of that for themselves by going to see your movie, Side Effects, if it comes to a theater near them, or being able to rent it sometime soon, as I hope you get greater distribution for this. And who knows, maybe Side Effects, the ongoing television sitcom.
Maybe. The film is all about just raising awareness with the general public and the medical community, because if we know how this works behind the scenes, they're not going to get away with playing the game the way that they have.
We'll leave that there for now. You have to log on to you can go right now, if you could, to coasttocoastam.com, and you can link up with Kathleen there. Thank you so much for your time. Look forward to that being a big success for you. The book is called The Secret Vaults of Time, Psychic Archaeology. Could you just walk around a field and say, dig here, based on a spirit? Wait till you hear that next on Coast to Coast AM.